Hello, this is Kathleen, and today, Wednesday, April 8th, I'll be reading to you from the Metro West Daily News. Boundless Potential. Hopkinton Bakery Sells Only Vegan Products by Caroline Bunnell. A new plant-based bakery has brought dairy and egg-free options to town. Boundless Bakery at 71 West Main Street has been operating under soft opening hours since March 14th, but plans to expand to full hours later this month. For owner Mike Glatfelter, the storefront marks the bakery's first permanent location after years of selling online and at local farmers markets. Inside, customers will find a menu centered on dairy and egg-free baked goods, including muffins, fruit bars, cookies, and a rotating selection of whoopie pies. Traditional chocolate and chocolate chip whoopie pies remain top sellers, while seasonal favorites such as lemon raspberry are especially popular in the summer, Glatfelter said. The bakery's name was chosen by Glatfelter's wife, who wanted something that reflected their philosophy, that baked goods can be made without boundaries, and that they can be just as delicious without dairy or eggs as they are with traditional ingredients. Glatfelter, a vegan himself, said many customers don't realize the baked goods are plant-based until after they've tried them. The bakery has also become a welcome stop for families managing food allergies, as no eggs or dairy are used anywhere in the kitchen. We have a lot of kids coming in and they're able to actually enjoy things because there are no eggs or milk in the kitchen. So that's a nice after effect, he said. The road to opening the Hopkinton Bakery began years earlier. Glatfelter spent much of his career working in IT, but attending culinary school on the side while living in Albany, New York. During COVID-19, his wife encouraged him to pursue baking full-time after noticing he was growing tired of the IT industry. In 2022, the couple moved to Massachusetts and launched Boundless Bakery from a small commercial kitchen in Walpole. They sold online and attended farmers markets and festivals to share their vegan items with customers. So far, Glatfelter said the community response has been overwhelmingly positive. All the local people that have driven by a lot and seen the coming soon sign have all been really eager to come inside, he said. We've had a lot of repeat customers and a lot of people coming in and buying stuff and not necessarily realizing it was vegan and finding that out. Glatfelter hopes to become involved with local events and markets and looks forward to meeting more members of the community. He added that several local charities have already reached out about potential partnerships for events. I'm a big people person, he said. I like talking with folks, so I'm eager to go from being in that small kitchen all day in Walpole to actually being able to interact with customers. Glatfelter plans to expand the Boundless Bakery's hours. It is currently open from 8 a.m. until 3 p.m. on Fridays and Saturdays, but the plan is to add Thursdays and additional days later in April. Podcast revives Teresa Corley's cold case, 1978 Bellingham Slaying, by Norman Miller. Teresa Corley was just 19 years old when she was murdered on December 6, 1978, in Bellingham. Nearly half a century later, no one has ever been charged. In 2015, Corley's sister, Geraldine Hood, started a Facebook page to drum up public interest in finding the killer. And outgoing Norfolk District Attorney Michael Morrissey has said the case is one that I would love to solve. Now there's a new podcast that's shining a fresh light on the case, hoping to get help to Corley's family to get closure. The Forgotten Files of Teresa Corley is a four-part podcast available on Spotify. Its host, Nicole Ryan, got her start in podcasting during the Karen Reed trial with a podcast called The Reed Report. Ryan, 28, of East Boston, studied journalism at Emerson College. After the Reed trial, Ryan is originally from Canton, the community where Reed's boyfriend, John O'Keefe, was found dead. She became interested in other Norfolk County cases, which is when she learned about Corley. "I thought there was a story here," Ryan told the Daily News in a recent phone interview. "Sure enough, I started looking into it and started researching the case, and I realized there was something there. If you ask most people in Norfolk County if they have heard of Karen Reed, they'll say yes. If you ask about Teresa Corley, you wouldn't get the same answer." Corley was a student at the now-defunct Holliston Junior College, hoping to become a medical assistant. On December 5, 1978, the Bellingham woman joined friends at a bar called the Train Stop Lounge in Franklin. At the time, the state's drinking age was 18. Corley left the bar at 11:30 p.m., according to reports. She was hitchhiking when she got picked up by four men. They took her to an apartment at President Arms Apartments in Franklin for several hours, where she was alleged to have been sexually assaulted by them. The men were never charged, and the statute of limitations has expired. After the alleged assaults, she left. She was last seen walking near Bellingham Center early in the morning of December 6th. She never returned home. Her naked body was found on December 8th on the side of the road near the northbound side of Interstate 495. It was determined that she had been strangled. The case has received more attention in recent years, propelled by Corley's family, particularly Hood, whom Ryan interviewed for her podcast. Hood has met several times with investigators, pushing to have Corley's body exhumed so that evidence could be collected. Ryan also interviewed other people, including a woman who said she was friends with the man who believed his son killed Corley. The four episodes, which range in length from 15 to 18 minutes apiece, discuss the history of the case and the efforts made by Hood and other family members to find the person responsible. "This case is about Teresa, but it's also about Hood, too," said Ryan. "It's about a sister who wants justice for her sister. This is a tragedy. Teresa was alone, by herself, and she was basically thrown out like trash. You can picture how awful it was if your sister, your mother, any woman close to you, was thrown on the side of the road naked like this." Hood said she thought the podcast did well and is happy that it may jog more people's memories to help get closure on the case. "I think Nicole did a really good job," Hood said of Ryan. "I was very impressed by the fact that she seemed to do a lot of good research. She's a great kid, and I think she did a great job of bringing a lot of the human aspect to it." Ryan said, looking back at the case, she feels like there was a lot of victim blaming by authorities. They looked at a young girl drunk and hitchhiking as putting herself in danger, but said she hopes with renewed interest and new technology the family can finally get answers. It's a really nuanced story that is heartbreaking and deserves more coverage, Ryan said. This is a really short series. It's meant to showcase the case and hopefully get some answers. Grand jury indicts man on charges linked to fatal crash, by Norman Miller, Framingham. A Middlesex County grand jury has indicted a Framingham man on charges connected to a fatal pedestrian crash last year on Route 9 in Framingham. The grand jury on April 2nd indicted Stuart Anderson, 45, on charges of vehicular homicide caused by operating a vehicle under the influence of drugs and negligence and leaving the scene of an accident that caused death or serious bodily injury. Authorities say that last May 25th, Julie Stewart, 41, appeared to be crossing the road at 10:25 p.m. near 1881 Worcester Road, Route 9, when she was struck and killed by a car allegedly driven by Anderson. According to the Middlesex District Attorney's Office, Anderson drove off after the crash. Authorities later found him at his home. His car had heavy front-end damage, the district attorney's office said. Anderson was initially charged with only leaving the scene of an accident that caused injury or serious bodily injury, but the grand jury also indicted him on vehicular homicide charge. Anderson had pled not guilty in Framingham District Court. He was initially held on $100,000 bail, but was later released on $10,000 bail after a Middlesex Superior Court judge reduced his bail on appeal. An arraignment date has not been set in Middlesex Superior Court. Amazon strikes new agreement with USPS, by David Shepherdson and Jacob Bogage, Reuters, Washington. Amazon on April 6th announced it reached a new agreement with the U.S. Postal Service on package deliveries, and sources said the cash-strapped mail system would retain about 80% of its existing deliveries from its biggest customer. That 20% cut is a dramatically better outcome for the postal agency than the two-thirds or larger reduction that Reuters reported last month Amazon had threatened. In March, USPS warned it could run out of cash as soon as October, and the risk that Amazon would replace the carrier by expanding its own delivery network or using rivals was an existential peril. Amazon will continue its delivery expansion, but short of growth that would rival the address-by-address reach of USPS, the sources said. Reuters first reported the deal. USPS has a roughly $80 billion budget, and Amazon represented $6 billion in annual revenue to the agency, according to two people familiar with the business arrangement. We're pleased to have reached a new agreement with USPS that furthers our long-standing partnership and will let us continue supporting our customers and communities together, Amazon said in a statement. USPS did not immediately comment on the announcement. Postmaster General David Steiner told Reuters in December that USPS delivered about 1.7 billion packages annually for Amazon. Amazon had criticized USPS plans to auction off access to its last mile delivery network. In April 2025, Amazon said it would spend more than $4 billion to expand its U.S. rural delivery network by the end of 2026. USPS said in March that it was seeking approval for a temporary 8% price hike for priority mail and package deliveries effective April 26th to deal with rising transportation and fuel costs. Steiner said in March, hiking the price of a first-class stamp to 95 cents from the current 78 cents would help USPS cut losses. USPS has reported net losses of $118 billion since 2007, as first-class mail, its most profitable product, has fallen to its lowest volume since the late 1960s. Former Marlboro man sentenced in gun trafficking case by Norman Miller. A former Marlboro man has been sentenced to 4 years in federal prison for illegally selling guns throughout the state. U.S. District Court Judge Patty B. Saris on Friday, April 3rd, also ruled that Guilherme Fernandez Tavares, 32, is subject to deportation once he serves his prison sentence. Fernandez Tavares is a Brazilian national, according to a federal Department of Justice press release. Fernandez Tavares pleaded guilty in November to one count of engaging in the business of dealing firearms without a license. He was charged in March as part of a federal investigation into gun trafficking throughout the United States. According to the DOJ press release, Fernandez Tavares sold several guns in 2024 to a witness working with federal authorities. They included a pistol with a high-capacity magazine that could hold 29 bullets. He also sold a pistol from which he illegally removed the serial number. He sold the witness 9 other guns during the investigation. The investigation began when U.S. postal inspectors seized a firearm sent from Florida to Fernandez Tavares in Massachusetts. Late Power Line Projects Blocking Reactor Start by Layla Kearney, Reuters, New York. Multiple power line projects that have been delayed for years could postpone the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant restart unless federal energy regulators grant waivers for the nuclear facility in Pennsylvania to connect to the grid speedily, plant owner Constellation Energy said in a recent filing. The U.S. power producer is working to restart a reactor at its Three Mile Island plant under the new name Crane Clean Energy Center by the end of 2027 under a contract to deliver electricity to the plant for use by Microsoft data centers. To connect to the grid, Crane will need approvals from the regional grid operator PJM Interconnection. Initial feedback from PJM said multiple transmission projects, some with in-service dates of December 2030, would need to be completed before Crane's more than 800 megawatts of electricity generating capacity can be delivered to the grid. Those projects include hundreds of miles of new 765 kilovolt and 500 kilovolt transmission lines as far away as West Virginia. Transmission lines which carry electricity from power plants and can cross multiple states are frequently delayed for years. Hurricane forecast map gets makeover. New graphic expands inland warnings by Dinah Boyles Pulver from USA Today. After a 2-year experimental run, an updated track forecast cone graphic moves into a starring role with the National Hurricane Center this summer. The new graphic, to debut when first tropical storm forms, is one of several changes the Hurricane Center is making for the Atlantic season that starts June 1st. Members of the Hurricane Center's staff sat down with USA Today at the National Hurricane Conference in Orlando to talk about the changes. The goal is to continue improving communications about hazards and risks with the public and emergency managers, said Michael Brennan, director of the Hurricane Center. The widely recognized five-day traffic graphic, often called the Cone of Uncertainty, had been used since 2002, but it was often misunderstood. It showed only the likely path of the center of the storm and markings along the coastlines where the tropical storm and hurricane watches and warnings were in effect. It did not show the full range of high winds, rain, and other impacts, including inland areas under watches and warnings. Revisions to the cone have been the subject of great debate and deliberation among the hurricane science community. The new graphic adds the inland tropical storm and hurricane watches and warnings in the continental United States, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, shading them with bright colors. That is to better convey the wind risk and better convey that the hazards can extend outside the cone, Brennan said. The new graphic was unveiled 2 years ago as an experimental tool for public comment regarding its effectiveness at communicating storm risks, said Bobby Berg, the Hurricane Center's warning coordination meteorologist. In the first year, there were questions about the legend and the colors we were using, so we fixed that, Berg said. After the second year, it seemed to be generally accepted, he said. Being able to provide watches and warnings inland from the coast is a more representative picture, he said. The new graphic will also be provided in an interactive version, where viewers will be able to zoom, pan, and save the image, he said. The goal is to be in a continual improvement process, Berg said. We're not going to just make a change and then sit on it again for 10 to 20 years. We want to be constantly making updates and new changes, he said. Also launching this year is the Hurricane Center's latest iteration of the cone graphic, another experimental version. The staff hopes it will do a better job of communicating risk and probability related to the storm's arrival by changing in two key ways. The old cone graphic and the graphic to be used this year are drawn using a set of concentric circles along the forecast track to illustrate where the center of the storm was expected to travel 2 out of 3 times, based on forecast errors over the previous 5 seasons. I don't think people really understood that well, Berg said. It was sometimes misunderstood as an indication of the storm's size and its impacts or as an absolute path for the center rather than a 67% probability. The circles will change to ellipses in the experimental graphic because their research has shown the flattened circles or ovals are more effective at illustrating potential forecast errors, both along the track and across the track, and it's based on a 90% probability, Berg said. That means a storm's center should move outside the ellipse only 1 out of every 10 times, making the cone a little larger, but lending higher forecast confidence that the center will stay within the cone. We actually have higher errors in the along track direction, meaning it's harder for us to nail the speed of the storm relative to how much it might go left or right, he said. He compares it to using a GPS map to estimate your drive time on a trip. The digital map draws your path, and you generally stay along that path. Maybe there's a slight detour here or there, he said, but your arrival time can change a lot depending on traffic conditions. Along a 5-day forecast, if the forward speed is off by only 5.7 miles per hour, accumulating over 120 hours, that is a much larger displacement between when the storm was forecast to arrive and when it actually arrives, Berg said. Tests on the new project show a much better representation of what the actual storm may do. All of the products are getting a lot better, said John Cangiolosi, a senior hurricane specialist at the Hurricane Center. But impacts are always going to fall outside the cone. The bottom line is we need to keep telling people you can't use this one map alone, Cangiolosi said. We need you to focus on the whole big picture. That's been part of the motivation behind developing the storm surge watches and warnings across the Caribbean and the Pacific, said Cody Fritz, the center's storm surge unit lead. They're rolling out the first storm surge watches and warnings and peak storm surge forecasts for Hawaii this year. People tend to focus so much on the center of the track that they're not really acknowledging the hazards that are associated outside the track. In some cases, hundreds of miles outside that track, he said. The cone is like the table of contents, Berg said. That's all it is. You don't get a full story by just reading the table of contents. You have to actually look at the other products to understand more about the risk. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you all have a safe and well day.